You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 18th. I'm Ellie Robinson from Drake University. Here is our first story. The first story we have here is about Revere's dance named Champs. It is a legislative piece on Iowa Western Community College with a subheading that leaders hope to wrap up quickly. And there's a big picture of a bunch of students and looks like a dance team in front of Canesville Arena and high school. This is written by Tim Rower, Council Bluffs Nonpareil. The dance team at Iowa Western Community College put its best foot forward at a tournament recently. The result was a pair of national championships. The Rivers finished led first in jazz and hip-hop at the 2024 Dance Team Union Junior College National Championship in Las Vegas this past weekend. The Iowa Western team finished second in POM. With a police escort, the team returned Monday to a rousing cheer from family, friends, and fellow students. "Thank you for your support," Coach Mick Patterson said as she sat off the bus. "This is awesome for them. It's being all in," she said, of her team's success. "It takes an incredible amount of time perfecting every little detail." Since fall, the start of the dance competition season, the Revere's held three-hour rehearsals 5 days a week, 6 to 7 hours during spring break, even 12 hours on Saturdays, Patterson said. Co-captain Abby Martin said, "It's nice to end the season on a good note. We're very excited to do what we want to do there." Fellow captain J.L. Lozano added, "We were focused energy. We were very satisfied on what we did." All right, the next story we have has a heading, Bill Reorganizing Boards Go Back to Senate. This was written by Caleb McGowan, the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill to reorganize and cut down the administrative boards and commissions in Iowa, but the proposal must be agreed to by the Senate before being sent to the governor for a signature. The bill, Senate File 2385, would eliminate dozens of state boards and commissions or consolidate them under other boards. Administrative boards have a range of duties, including rulemaking, overseeing professions, advising state agencies, and allocating budgets. The Senate passed the proposal last week, but the House amended the bill and sent it back to the chamber for approval. It passed the House 54-42. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds proposed a bill to reorganize the state boards this year after a committee spent too much of last summer reviewing boards and developing recommendations. The committee was created under a large government reorganization bill Reynolds signed into law last year. Reynolds' proposal this year called for cutting or consolidating 111 of Iowa's boards and commissions, cutting the number of boards down to 145 after the reorganization. The bill aligns in some ways with Reynolds' original proposal, but it would leave intact some boards that Reynolds called to dissolve. In calling for the change this year, Reynolds said they would make state government more efficient and allow more decisions to be made by elected officials rather than appointed boards. Republicans echoed those arguments during a floor debate on this proposal. "This bill is about maximizing meaningful public participation in the boards and commissions process, and it increases state government accountability and efficiency by eliminating unnecessary bureaucracy," Senator Chris Coronary, R. LeClaire, said during Senate debate last week. Then there's a subheading that says, "Which boards will be eliminated?" The sprawling bill, which spans more than 250 pages, eliminates a number of boards that are no longer meeting or serve a function that is no longer needed, while other eliminations called for in the bill have caused concern among some lawmakers and advocacy groups. The bill would remove boards serving underrepresented groups, including commissions on Latino affairs, the status of women, African Americans, people with disabilities, Native Americans, Deaf Services, and Asian and Pacific Islanders. The duties of those boards would be brought under the Human Rights Board. The bill would combine some healthcare boards, including creating a behavioral health professionals board that would govern psychology, social work, and therapy professionals. The bill would bring several other existing healthcare boards under the Council of Health and Human Services. The bill would also eliminate the Public Employment Relations Board, which oversees labor practices for public employees, and move its authority under the Employment Appeal Board. The next subheading is Other Changes. The bill would create a new State Government Efficiency Review Committee that would regularly review the state board's commissions. The committee, which would be tasked with reviewing 1/4 of boards each year, they would evaluate a board's efficiency and effectiveness and make recommendations for changes or elimination. Representative Jane Bloomingdale from Northwood, who managed the bill in the House, said the review committee was the most important piece of the bill. "We're setting up a review committee that we have talked about since I was elected 8 years ago," Bloomingdale said. "If we made a mistake, I feel like if we merge the boards, we'll unmerge them. Various measures in the bill would remove authority that is given to state boards and bring them under the agency or department they serve, giving executive staff appointed by the governor more rulemaking and decision power. Several boards and commissions that meet on a set schedule would be changed to meet on an as-need basis, and the bill would require government bodies at all levels to run hybrid meetings that allow for remote participation. The next subheading says Culture Board Cuts Objected. Democrats who hold a minority in both chambers field a number of amendments and argued the bill would take power away from important boards, including the serving underrepresented communities. Pointing to the move of rulemaking authority under executive agencies, Democrats argued the bill would consolidate power under the governor and away from the volunteer bodies. "We had the opportunity to come together, get rid of some boards and commissions that we were clearly unnecessary, and make a government that is more efficient and listens to Iowans," said Representative Adam Zander from Iowa City. "What we ended up with was a power grab that takes away the rights of Iowans and the voices of Iowans in the process of government." Representative Jerome Amos, a Democrat from Waterloo, proposed an amendment to reinstate the board serving underrepresented communities, arguing they served a vital role in governing minority populations, a voice in state government. The amendment, along with several others proposed by Democrats, was voted down by Republicans. What it's going to do is going to water down the voices of individuals that live in the state, he said. "Originally, you have a commission report that actually was made up by those different ethnicity, ethnic groups, and they actually had a voice, a collective voice. But what this is going to do is going to take away that voice," Bloomingdale said. "The groups would still have representation on the Human Rights Board. Every one of these groups will be represented on the Human Rights Board," Bloomingdale said. "And by bringing these people together, we're hoping to expand their voice and create action." The next story is a local news story about Attorney Handles High-Profile Cases, is the heading. And then there's a picture of this attorney in his office. Looks like his office at home. It's kind of like a dark wood office with a stone wall in the background with some lights. And then his desk has a bunch of important papers on it, it looks like. And then his laptop is facing up and his desk chair is there. And he's standing in front of his desk with his arms crossed, smiling. So it kind of just looks like he's, like, posing, showing that, like, he has a lot of, like, important work that he's in charge of and that he's proud of. So this was written by Tim Rower, Council Buffs Nonpareil. "Martin Cannon may be a local attorney, but his casework has been felt nationwide. Cannon, who lives in rural Potawatomi County, serves as one of the few senior counsels at the Thomas More Society, a nonprofit public interest law firm. We do cases across the country in defense of religious liberty, freedom of speech, pro-life, protecting basic American principles, he said. We do everything free of charge, and we spend everything that comes into the organization. Cannon described the society as conservative. It's not Catholic by definition. It has headquarters in Omaha and Chicago with officers in New York and California. Cannon, whose father, Martin Sr., was a successful attorney in the metro area, is a Creighton University graduate and has been a member of the Thomas More Society for many years now. He has been quite busy. I've tried 4 or 5 FACE cases, he said, referring to the Freedom of Access to Clinic and Traces Act. Cannon secured the release of Catholic priests after defending him against federal charges for blocking an abortion clinic. He's also been involved in a high-profile case, not only defending a woman arrested on FACE charges, but also seeking a congressional investigation into the fate of 5 unborn babies whose bodies Handy recovered from a Washington abortion clinic in 2022. Cannon has also represented the state of Iowa in a challenge against the state's so-called fetal heartbeat law, which was back in the news last week as the Iowa Supreme Court considers upholding the 6-week abortion ban. Cannon and his wife, Chris, some others found Free Speech America, which puts on events for focusing on the importance of freedom of speech. Among these events is a fireworks show every year at West Fair. We're getting ready for our 4th year, he said. Okay, the next one is kind of just like a fun little local news story. A woman wins $10,000 in Lotto Scratcher. Stacy Butler won a $10,000 prize playing in Iowa's lottery Ruby Red crossword scratch game. And there's a picture of her with a check that's really, really big. So it's obviously like a written out cardboard check for $10,000. And it has like the logo of the Iowa lottery. And then in the background, there's a backdrop of the Iowa lottery logo all over. And it's just her holding up that check, smiling, because obviously she's super happy that she just won. And then the little paragraph says, a Council Bluffs woman has won a $10,000 lottery prize. Stacy Butler won the 13th prize of $10,000 in Iowa's lottery, Ruby Red crossword scratch game. According to a news release, she purchased her winning ticket at Casey's 4727 Southern Hills Drive in Sioux City. She claimed her prize earlier this month at lottery headquarters in Clive. Ruby Red Crossword is a $30 scratch game that features 16 top prizes of 300,047 prizes of $10,000 and overall odds of 1 in 2.29. For more information, visit iowalottery.com. All right, and then now we're going to kind of jump to more local news. This is a story about a college local news, and then we'll go back to some politics news. So this heading is University of Iowa College Pharmacy, students work with drug donations. And there's a picture of 3 students working in what looks like a storage room, collecting a bunch of donations, I assume, and then it looks like they're organizing and packaging them and getting ready to send them out. This was written by Brooklyn Drazy, Iowa Capital Dispatch. It was business as usual for the SafeNet RX staff working on a recent Saturday morning, sifting through boxes and totes of medication packets, inhalers, and medical supplies donated by long-term care centers and clinics. They checked the integrity of the packaging, verified the dosage and expiration, removed any identifying information, and filed it away to eventually be sent to a patient in need. For the 3 University of Iowa pharmacy students volunteering at the nonprofit for the day, the act of making medicine that would have otherwise been thrown out available for use by those who need it but can't afford it showed them how they can help their patients and now in the future. I think it's kind of an eye-opener and sort of makes you think more about undeserved populations and what goes into helping them. University of Iowa student and pharmacy technician Elise Weikert said, SafeNet Rx is a Grimes-based nonprofit that takes drug donations from across the country that provides them to pharmacies and clinics in Iowa patients in Iowa for patients at or below 200% of the federal poverty line. Staff and volunteers at the organization check to ensure any medications that will be sent out are properly labeled and packaged, and any unusable drugs are safely disposed of. According to SafeNet Rx, more than $121 million worth of medications have been donated, and around 141,000 underserved patients have received medication through the nonprofit. SafeNet Rx CEO John Roseman said the nonprofit relies heavily on volunteers to help the input the medications, and through internships with universities like University of Iowa and Drake University, students will come in for a day or longer to help out. It is critical to include students in this kind of work, he said, because it teaches both them that safe NRX is here for if their patients need it, and shows them that if they can't access the nonprofit, then maybe they can start one up somewhere else. We have so many students that have either done a rotation here, or they might have worked here. They came here through an event with Drake or the University of Iowa, and years later they will contact us and say, hey, you can help with this, Rossman said, so it does have a very powerful impact. Each of the University of Iowa students volunteering at SafeNet works with the community pharmacies as well, and know just how high the cost of medications are. University of Iowa student Gabrielle Martin said this issue was one of the reasons she decided to pursue pharmacy in order to help. None of them, however, had heard of the nonprofit or knew that resources like it were available. All of these meds could have been useful, but they don't have the manpower to be able to keep up with the demand for it, University of Iowa pharmacy student Caitlin Nuring said. All right, next we're actually going to do a little business piece instead, because I do have one today included. This one says, job relocations on the decline. And this has a picture of a bird's eye view of a neighborhood. So, like, if you were to be, like, in an airplane and, like, looking down, that's, like, what it looks like. And it's, like, the end of a neighborhood, like a cul-de-sac. And it's just all these houses overlooking them. This was written by Mark Niquette, Michael Sassos, and Reed Brown from Bloomberg News. Manager recruits in the industry Midwest are shunning offers to move to the American South, in part because they're locked into super low 30-year mortgages. A tight labor market that's allowing workers to stay closer to home, rising housing costs, and a post-pandemic shift towards a remote or hybrid work arrangement are making it a challenge for employees to entice managers, according to Andy Challenger, the senior vice president of Challenger, Gray and Christmas Incorporated, an executive coaching firm. What's more recent data signals the amount saved on potentially lower taxes and costs by moving south is shrinking. All that helps explain why number of U.S. job seekers who relocated for a new job fell to 1.5% in the fourth quarter last year, the lowest level on record, according to the Challenger survey. Dominique Kaganga, a sales director for a major automotive supplier in Macomb County, Michigan, said he turned down an offer last year to relocate to South Carolina. Recruiters still reach out at least a few times a month, but his family is established in Michigan. Plus, he's got a low-interest mortgage. The incentive wasn't significant enough, he said. Potential hires paying low-interest mortgages are often reluctant to move unless they offered relocation packages that account for the differential in housing costs, said Janet Rivera-Jones, founder of Florida-based Five Star Global Recruitment Partners. About one-fifth of U.S. homes owners have a mortgage with less than 3% interest, and almost 35% have a rate between 3 and 4, according to Bloomberg's analysis of Federal Housing Finance Agency mortgage data. Current rates for a fixed 30-year mortgage are about 7% and have more than doubled since hitting their historic lows of 2.85% in December of 2020. They don't want to sell that house that they bought for a 2% or 3% interest rate and buy down here at 8%, Jones said. Companies have to offer relocation. That is a must. At the same time, the cost of worker relocations is on the rise. For mid-level managers, the average U.S. relocation have been increasing since 2020, hitting $78,330 for homeowners last year and $330,000 for renters, according to data from ARC Relocation, a consulting that relocates employees for federal agencies and corporate clients. You have to offer relocation, and then it's still a 50-50 shot that the person will take it, Jones said. They don't want to move at this time. Then there's the matter of pay. The average annual pay for an automotive plant manager in the southeastern U.S. can run from $150,000 to $250,000 in salary, bonuses, and other perks, according to Jones. Other managers can earn $120,000 to $130,000 annually, and senior-level managers can make more than $160,000. But salaries in Michigan for all manager roles are typically around 15 to 20% higher than comparable roles in the South, she said. The problem of attracting talent to the U.S. South is being felt most acutely by automakers and suppliers who are building a new or expanding massive campuses across the regions. Companies like Hyundai Motor Company, Kia Corporation, and Ford Motor Company have seared billions of dollars of electric vehicle-related incentives into building or expanding manufacturing facilities. Automakers announced that $133 billion in EV-related investment alone in the United States is between 2018 and 2023 is more than half of which was sent to the southern states, according to the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The investments have translated into new or expanded electric vehicle and other automotive plants across the region. To fill entry-level positions at these facilities, recruiters have found local workers, but hiring experienced senior and mid-level managers in the region has been a much steeper challenge. So they've turned to the Midwest, said Alan Amosy, the president and chief executive of the Center for Automotive Research. You're going to fish in that pond that has the fish, and the experienced people are genuinely going to be in the Midwest, he said. Michigan led the nation in 2020 with 182,000 motor vehicle parts manufacturing jobs versus 28,000 in Georgia. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, there were 1.5 times more automotive jobs in the Great Lakes than in the Southeast, federal data showed. But while automotive employment in the Great Lakes has increased by 6% since 2015, the number of automotive vehicles and parts manufacturing jobs in the Southeast has increased by 13% during that time, according to economic analysis data. Brad Holden, co-founder of Search Firm, started a new unit specifically to help clients looking for mid-level managers, especially to work at the factory level. Most of the plant management jobs pay at least $200,000, and the automakers are willing to pay $30,000 to $40,000 more than suppliers, he said. The demand is really high. It drives up costs and competition, Holden said. All right, and then for the last part of this first section, we're going to do one more business piece on Disney CEO race. And this one also has a picture. It's a picture of the logo of the Walt Disney Corporation in what looks like California, where Disney World or Disneyland is. So it's like outside, a bunch of trees, the pillars and the sign is orange, and then the wording is navy blue that says the wall. All right, and this was written by Meg James, Ryan Fonger, Samantha Masanga, and Stefan Badalogo. Walt Disney Corporation Chief Executive Bob Iger has prevailed in the company's shareholder fight against billionaire dissident Nelson Peltz, but the celebrated executive's most challenging task remains selecting someone to fill his big shoes. The 73-year-old chief is set to retire in 2026, assuming he steps down as planned. For decades, succession planning has been among the Burbank giant's most vexing issue. During Iger's first highly successful 15-year run, he delayed his planned retirement multiple times, and potential successors, including former Chief Operating Officer Tom Staggs, left the company in frustration. Peltz and the others pointed to the bungled handoff to Parks head Bob Chapek as proof that Disney Board of Directors, who oversees the succession of process, weren't up to the job. Chapek's tumultuous turn lasted less than 3 years. Iger returned in late 2022 to replace him. Succession is the board's number one priority, Iger said during a recent appearance on CNBC. Disney historically promotes from within, but board members currently are looking at potential external candidates as well, as four top executives, Disney Entertainment co-chair Donna Walden, who oversees television, fellow entertainment co-chair Alan Bergman, who runs the film studios. Walden and Bergman share oversight of streaming. Parks, Products, and Experiences Josh D'Amaro, and ESPN boss James Spataro. Disney's leading contenders have their own areas of expertise as well as blind spots. None of the experiences of running a $220 billion multifaceted media and entertainment empire such as Disney, but then again, neither did Iger before he ascended to the throne in 2005. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines. I'm Ellie Robinson from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. All right, next we are going to be reading the obituaries. There's two for today. The first one is Mildred G. Midge Guzer, September 4th. She lived from September 4th, 1929 to April 16th, 2024. Mildred G. Midge Guzer, age 94, of Council Bluffs, passed away on April 16th, 2024 at Amelia Place. Midge was born September 4th in 1929 in Portsmouth, Iowa, to the late John J. and Conjuga Foos. She married Marvin Chaban on January 11th in 1951 at St. Mary's Church in Portsmouth. They were blessed with three children, Myron, Peggy, and Patricia. Peggy preceded Midge in 1953 at the age of 9 months, and husband Marvin preceded Midge in 1965 at the age of 38. Midge was a farm and wife and homemaker. She married Donald Guzer on September 11, 1971, and made Council Bluffs their home. Midge was a member of St. Peter Catholic Church, St. Anne's Altar and Rosary Society, and was the funeral lunch chairperson for many years at St. Peter's. In addition, her parents, daughter, and husband, Midge was preceded in death by her siblings. Bill Fuss in 1996, Bernadine Knuckle in 1998, Rita Shaben in 2007, Robert Fuss in 2020, and Patricia Smith in 2021. Midge is survived by her husband of 52 years, Don Gozer of Council Bluffs, son Myra Nancy Shaben of Defense, Iowa, daughter Patricia Larson of Council Bluffs, seven granddaughters, six great-grandchildren, sister Marion Kramer of Harlan, Iowa, brother Joe Fuss of Omaha, Nebraska, many nieces and nephews, recitation of the Rosary Sunday 5 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian Burial Monday 10 a.m. at St. Peter Catholic Church in St. Bluff, in Council St. Bluffs. A lunch will immediately follow in Caddis Hall in St. Peter's Interment in St. Joseph's Cemetery. Early Erling, Iowa at 2 p.m., memorials are suggested to St. Peter Catholic Church or the American Cancer Society. All right, for the next obituary, we have Duane Philip Bolt. He lived from December 13th, 1962 to April 13th, 2024. Duane Philip Bolt passed away peacefully in his sleep on April 13th, 2024, at Bethany Lutheran after a lifelong battle with Crohn's disease and many other chronic conditions. Duane was born to the late Irwin Frank Bolt and Dolores May Cole on December 13th, 1962, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He was the youngest of four children. Duane was preceded in death by his father, Irwin Bolt, and all of his siblings, David Bolt, Ralph Bolt, and Linda Albert, as well as his niece, Lynn. Duane leaves behind his loving mother, matriarch, and his caretaker of many years, Dolores Bolt of Council Bluffs, his nieces Leanne Johnson of Council Bluffs, Aaron Bluffs, and Royce Morse of Neola, Iowa, his nephews George Bolt and Lucas Art, both of Council Bluffs. Seven great nieces and nephews, many supportive friends and caretakers, and his loyal companion, Sammy the Cat. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. at Church of Christ on Friday, April 19th, 2024. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. at Church of Christ on Friday, April 19th, 2024. Interment is in Memorial Park Cemetery. Friends and family are welcome to gather for lunch at Council Bluffs Church of Christ at 1525 McPherson Avenue. Following the service, your presence and support during this time of mourning are deeply appreciated. By Dolores Bolt. All right, now we will be going on to reading sports for a majority of the rest of the time. And then we will also be reading like some lifestyle news as well, things like that. So the first story we have here is a local high school track and field story. Denton sets Saints school record in 3,000. And it's a picture of this girl running, who I assume broke the record. She has red hair. The background is like blurred and it's like focused on her. Elsie's Eachhorn wins 3,200 in field with four top 10 state finishers. This was written by Peter Burnett, the non-pro. Several top times were set in pristine conditions at Lewis Central's co-ed invitational, and Lily Denton set a new St. Albert record as clouds gave way to clear skies. For Denton, her 3,000-meter win just missed the Drake Relays cut time, 10:20, but her time, 10:22.67, broke the Saints school record in the 300 and leads 1A by 11 seconds. Winning the race meant a lot after the most recent meet for the Saints was canceled. With a school regulated time of 6:15 p.m., St. Albert was limited to the early track events. This meet, we were trying to get more girls to Drake and qualify or at least just get there. Because with our last meet being canceled and Friday morning, the last time to submit times for Drake, Denton said. Denton finished ahead of Harlan's Lindsay Sonderman. I knew coming in that she was seated higher than me, so just trying to stick with her and pace off of that, she said. Following Denton's win, Ethan Eckhorn, Lewis Central, came out on top in the boys' 3200, which featured four top 10 finishers from last year's state meet. With a time of 9:21.5, Eckhorn also hit a blue standard to qualify for Drake. Glenwood's Andrew Smith and Bryant Keller followed in second and third. Due to similar rules in St. Albert, the Rams brought just a few track athletes, including the team of Jackson Mulkins, Trey Darner, Peyton Longmurn, and Cooper DeLashman, and those for field events. The boys' 4x800 was won by St. Albert's team of Luke Wenegill, Owen Wise, Jacob Bowsel, Parker Heiserkamp by just 1 second ahead of Lewis Central. The Falcons led Iowa by 3 seconds. Trainer's team of Brady Wallace, Brock Casey, Kay Cones, and Carson Elwood won the boys' shuttle hurdles in 1:02.1, in spite of Elwood taking a spill. The all-class leading Cardinals finished the first again. Underwood's Max Tyerks and Lewis Central's Jordan Matawat won both throw events. All right, the next story is now more like nationwide, but specifically also associates with Iowa. Clark, as expected, goes number one to Fever. This was written by Doug Fierenberg, Associated Press. New York. Caitlin Clark admitted she was a bit nervous before getting chosen with the number one pick in the WNBA draft by Indiana Fever, even though it was no surprise. I dreamed of this moment since I was in second grade, and it's taken a lot of hard work, a lot of ups and downs, but more than anything, just trying to soak it in. Clark said the former Iowa star became a household name among basketball fans during her record-breaking college season, and she will now try to help receive the Indiana franchise, along with last season's number one pick, Aliyah Boston, who previously played with Clark on a USA Basketball Under-19 team. Obviously going to an organization that has, in my eyes, one of the best post players in the entire world, Clark said. My point guard eyes just lit up at that. And obviously, Aliyah has been one of my teammates before. I'm excited. I can't wait. The Fever taking Clark has been a foregone conclusion since she announced on February 29th she would turn pro. Nearly 17,000 tickets were claimed to watch the draft at Gainbridge Fieldhouse in Indianapolis, home to the Fever and the NBA's Indiana Pacers. Clark has helped bring millions of fans to women's game with her signature shots from the midcourt logo and passing ability. The NCAA's all-time scoring leader was a big reason why a record 18.9 million viewers turned into the national championship game, which Iowa lost to unbeaten South Carolina. The Hawkeyes were also the national runners-up to LSU a year earlier. It's been a whirlwind few weeks for Clark. After the title game, she flew to Los Angeles to receive the John R. Wooden Award and then came to New York for an appearance on Saturday Night Live. I think, obviously, the course of the last few weeks has been pretty insane in my life. The last 2 months playing basketball as long as I possibly could in my college career, Clark said. I think the biggest thing is I'm just very lucky to be in this moment, and all these opportunities and these things, they're once in a lifetime. Clark, who wore a white Prada jacket and skirt, hugged her parents and brothers and Iowa coach Lisa Boulder after she was drafted. The draft was held at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in front of 1,000 fans who bought all the tickets within 15 minutes of them going on sale a few months ago. Los Angeles chose Stanford's Cammer Brink at number two. She'll get to stay in California and gives the Sparks a two-way player. When they called my name, a huge wave of emotions hit me, Brink said. I saw my mom tearing up and my dad, and it hit home. A prolific scorer, Brink was also the Naismith Defensive Player of the Year. The Sparks needed to replace franchise player Nneka Okwamik, who left Seattle in free agency. Brink's godmother, Sonia Curry, is the mother of Golden State Warriors' Steph Curry. I FaceTimed Steph 5 minutes before the show started, and he said, "Have fun with it," Brink said. He can share so much great advice since he's been through this. Make stuff like this as fun as it can be stressed. Chicago had the third pick and chose South Carolina's Camilo Cardozo before the Sparks were on the clock again and selected Tennessee's Rekia Jackson. Cardozo had a busy week helping the Gamecocks win the national championship to compete an undefeated season. She took part in the team's championship parade on Sunday before traveling to New York. Dallas took Ohio State guard J.C. Sheldon with the fifth pick. Washington drafted Aliyah Edwards of UConn sixth before Chicago took LSU's Angel Reese, number seven, pairing her with Cardozo. "She's a great player, and I'm a great player. Nobody's going to get rebounds on us," the 6'7" Cardozo said, laughing. Minnesota, which had swapped picks with Chicago, drafted Alyssa Philly of Utah 8. A pair of French guards, Carla Liet and Leo Lacan, went next to Dallas and Connecticut, respectively. New York drafted Ole Miss' Markeisha Davis at number 11, and Atlanta closed out the first round by taking Australian Naiduo Pouch. The champs are here. Two-time defending champion Las Vegas didn't have a first-round pick, but made the most of their three second-round choices. The Aces chose Syracuse guard Daisha Fair, who finished as the third leading scorer in NCAA Division I history, with the 16th pick. Two picks later, they chose Iowa's own Kate Martin. The team closed out the round drafting Virginia Tech's Elizabeth Kitley, who is recovering from a torn ACL. She's out for the season and showed up on crutches. All right, the next sports story we have is about a high school tennis team nearby. Lewis Central edges Abraham Lincoln. And it's a picture of this kid playing tennis. And once again, it's like zoomed in on him and the background is blurred out. He's wearing just like his regular tennis uniform, has a hat on, and is about to serve, it looks like. This was written by Peter Burnett, the nonpareil. In a match postponed from April 11th, Lewis Central edged Abraham Lincoln 5-4, a repeat of last year's results. In spite of the postponement, weather was still less than ideal as thunderstorms began to roll in and the wind picked up. I decided to go ahead and play in it last night, not the best conditions, but pretty happy with getting out there with the wind, Titans coach Chris Haffen said. We had some guys step up in singles and then get a big win out of Max Hubbard and Bryson Jensen to clinch things. The Hubbard-Jensen win came via 8-4 victory at number 2 doubles. After going 4-2 in singles, the Titans lost number 1 and number 3 doubles, thus making number 2 the decider. Hampton said the pair began making shots and played smarter. Tennis a lot of times comes down to that, Hoffman said. It's not always who has the best strokes, but who's playing smarter and can keep the ball in play. All right, the next story is of predicting the picks, and it's a spotlight of a mock draft. And it's a picture of UNC quarterback throwing the ball, and it's just zoomed in on him, and the background's blurred again. This was written by Rob Matteo, Associated Press. The madness begins early in our look at the 2024 mock draft. 8 trades in the first round, 2 swaps in the top 5, 1 team moves down and back up, another makes 3 trades going down twice before a move up to snatch a quarterback. A division champion trades out of the first round. It's no secret that Chicago Bears are taking Caleb Williams with the number one overall pick. The 2022 Heisman Trophy winner at USC has been ticketed for the top selection for months. The Washington Commanders are expected to choose between LSU's Jaden Daniels, the 2023 Heisman winner, and North Carolina's Drake Mayer at number two. Then, the New England Patriots are expected to take the remaining quarterback. Or will they? Here's how we see it going down. Number one, Chicago Bears Caleb Williams. Williams is the consensus number one pick. The Bears already traded away Justin Fields, their 2021 first-round pick, and now finally have a long-term answer at the most important position. Number two, Washington Commanders. Jaden Daniels, quarterback, LSU. The 2023 Heisman Trophy winner is an ideal fit for new offensive coordinator Cliff Kingsburg, who had some success with dual draft QB Kyler Murray in Arizona. At 3, Minnesota Vikings. Drake May, quarterback, North Carolina. Despite signing Sam Arnold to a $10 million one-year deal after losing Kirk Cousins to Atlanta, the Vikings are looking for a franchise QB. They send picks to number 11 and 23 plus a 2025 first rounder to New England for number 3 and 2025 third and sixth rounders. May won't have to start right away but could replace Darnold after a handful of games. Number 4, Buffalo Bills. Maven Harrison Jr., wide receiver, Ohio State. Harrison, the son of Hall of Fame receiver Marvin Harrison, was the best wide receiver on the field last season. His stock has slipped some because he skipped off-season workouts, but his tape is enough. The Bills are under pressure to win a Super Bowl and need a number one wideout after trading Stephon Diggs. This blockbuster deal sends pick number 28, a second rounder, 60, a fourth, a fifth, and 2025 first, second to Arizona for number 4 and a 2025 fourth rounder. And then at number 5, Los Angeles Chargers are predicted to draft Malik Nabers, wide receiver from LSU. New Chargers coach Jim Harbaugh loves offensive linemen, but Keenan Allen and Mike Williams are gone. Justin Herbert needs playmakers. With elite 8 ballers, skills, and explosive route running ability, he got 89 balls for 156.9 yards. For 1,569 yards and 14 touchdowns last season. And then the rest of this article goes all the way down to the 32nd pick, so I'm not going to keep reading it because that's a lot. But it pretty much just is like a mock draft that they predicted. And it has like the Tennessee Titans, the Bears' next pick, the New York Jets, the Falcons, a bunch of teams. And if you want to, like, read about that further, you can always just, like, find that anywhere. There's so many, like, sports sources like ESPN, CBS, anything like that, that have done mock drafts that you can find. Okay, and then lastly, I think this will be the last story. This is a story on faith and culture. Let Love Be the Law. This was written by Luis Andres Hano from Associated Press. Proudly wearing a rainbow-colored clergy stole and a rainbow flag in her clear collar, the Reverend Elaine Sargley welcomed all to her LGBTQ+ inclusive church in the Cuban port city of Matanzas. "We're all invited, and no one can exclude us," Sargley told same-sex couples who held hands sitting on wooden pews in the Metropolitan Community Church, where she had recently married her wife. These words and this kind of gathering would have been unimaginable before in the largest country in the conservative and mostly Christian Caribbean, where anti-gay hostility is widely spread. Cuba represented gay people after its 1959 revolution led by Fidel Castro and sent many to labor camps. But in recent years, the communist-run island barred anti-gay discrimination, and in 2022, government-backed family law, approved by popular vote, allowed same-sex couples the right to marry and adopt. members of Cuba's LGBTQ plus community, said it marked down a milestone that had allowed them to embrace their gender identity and worship more freely in a country that for decades after the revolution was officially atheist. Over the past quarter century, it has gradually become more tolerant of religions. It's huge. There aren't enough words to say what an opportunity it is to achieve the dream of many, said Mikhailo Aforga. He was with his husband, Vladimir Marin, near the altar, where at Friday service they joined other congregants taking turns to lay offerings of white and pink wildflowers to thank God. It's the opportunity for all people to present here, he said, to gather and participate without regard to their gender, race, or religion. In the early years after the 1959 revolution, homophobia in Cuba was no different from the rest of the world. In the United States, homosexuality was deemed a mental disorder by psychiatric authorities, and gay sex was a crime in most states. Currently, Russia, a major supporter of Fidel Castro, when it was the core of the Communist Soviet Union, is bucking the worldwide trend of greater LGBTQ acceptance with a multi-pronged crackdown on the LGBTQ activism. The previous Cuban family code, dating back to the 1975, stipulated that marriage was between a man and a woman, not between two people, which excluded lifelong partners from inheritance rights. The new law goes further than marriage equality, which activists tried to include in the Constitution in 2019. Without success or the ability for gay couples to adopt or use surrogates, it also expanded rights for children, the elderly, and women. The first members of the congregation began gathering on a house terrace in Madden's Moor than a decade ago to sing and pray. The sky was our ceiling, and when it rained, we'd all pack into a small room, Sargo said. In 2015, with support from the U.S. LGBTQ plus affirming metropolitan community churches, they covered a house into a church decked with wooden pews and a stained glass that hangs above the altar. Underneath, a local Buddhist group that meets during the week stores its musical instruments, an example of interfaith partnership. This church is a family, said Sarguli, who has a tattoo of the Jesus fish, one of the forearms, and wears a Buddhist bracelet. It's a sacred space, not just because there's a cross or an altar, but because it's the most sacred space for people to have a space. It's where they come to have their safe space. It's the essence of the Bible, God is love, and other churches should emphasize that instead of repressing and harming others with a supposed sin, said Salzer, who was born a woman and this year started homeroom treatment. Sin and love are not the same, said Salzer, who wore an earring in the shape of a cross. And to love, he added, is not a sin. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 18th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Ellie Robinson from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.